Well, the hot stove season, not as hot as we were hoping. There has been some movement since we last talked, but we're here to tell you what's going on in the fantasy baseball world. I'm Adam Azer with Al Melchior and Scott White. On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your Thanksgivings? Scott, first, then Al.
Speaking of hot stoves, scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best, I'll give it about 8.5. Solid.
What would make it a 10?
I don't even know. I have no idea.
Thanksgiving X Factor. So mine was a 10. I had a great time. Good.
Wow. Wow.
Glad to hear
And you know what pushed it over the top?
What's that?
Chris Towers' Thanksgiving DFS contest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, did you see that?
No.
Did you play?
No, I didn't play. I wanted in on that. For football?
Build a plate for $50,000.
Oh, the actual food thing. Yes, that was really cool. I did see that. I did not participate, though.
You missed out. But my actual Thanksgiving dinner was fantastic.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. And I'm glad to be back chatting with you guys. Since you are just so rude, you're not even going to ask how mine was. We'll just move on. Email us.
Hey, Adam.
No, I don't care anymore. I don't even want to talk about it. FantasyBaseball@CBSI.com. FantasyBaseball@CBSI.com. Great time to send your emails. We have some free time on our hands, so we'll read as many as we can. All right, today, Scott and Al are going to talk about the lessons they learned while they were doing their solo mock drafts, drafting basically for 12 different teams all by themselves, round by round, and what they kind of learned. Actually, interesting stuff about the depth at certain positions. Also, did you hear the comments about Robinson Cano? They are pretty awesome. I will read them to you. First, our email of the day. Oh, also, we have the Jordan Zimmerman news, Jake Arrieta news, J-Hap news, blah, blah, blah. Email of the day is from Vern. Come on, Verno. He says, how does one determine how to distinguish an SP1 from, say, an SP3? SP3 versus SP5, so, you know, number one starter, number three starter. Is it their rotation order? More than that. Then there's the tiers. You know, do they correlate? I find comments like, he's a tier three pitcher confusing. How does one determine what makes a pitcher fit into the various tiers?
Well, it depends on how susceptible you are to sunburns.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's got
SP5.
Anything lower than SP50.
Yeah.
You might as well not even draft a starting pitcher at all.
Yeah. Well, those designations really just match up with where you'd put them in your fantasy rotation. So, I mean, in an ideal world, in a 12-team league, the 12 top pitchers would be an SP1. 13 through 24 would be SP2. But, of course, there's a lot of interchangeability sometimes around those cutoffs. I think this year there's probably close to 20 pitchers I would call an SP1.
Wow, really?
And then maybe about 6 pitchers I'd call an SP2. So, yeah, I mean, part of it just comes with experience and knowing and recognizing what kind of production you expect from each of those SP slots. And then so it becomes, you know, kind of a reverse attribution where knowing what you should expect from pitchers in those slots, we describe pitchers in those slots to give you an idea of their expectations. So I could see how it could be confusing, but if you just think of it kind of the way Al broke it down, where in an ideal world, 1 through 12 would be SP1s, 13 through 24 SP2s, and so on, I think that simplifies it for you.
And tiers really are a totally different thing, because that has to do with where you see the quality drop off. So, you know, while I said that there's roughly 20 pitchers I would call an SP1, that isn't really all one tier, because the first tier for me is probably only 5 or 6 pitchers deep. Mm-hmm. But then there's another, you know, 15 or so pitchers that aren't as good, but, you know, they're good enough to be your first pitcher if you don't get one of, you know, what I would call the true elite aces.
Well, so let's take a guy like Danny Salazar. No, let's take his teammate, Carlos Carrasco. 17th for Scott.
Now, let's you talk Kluber.
What'd you say?
Let's talk about Kluber. I'm just
No. Too easy. Too easy, yeah. Carrasco, 17th for Scott and 21st for Al. So do you consider Carrasco an SP1, a number one fantasy starting pitcher?
I don't. Just outside. It's an SP2.
Okay.
I call him an SP1. It is on the fringier side because he hasn't really had that 200 inning season yet, but now we're talking back to back seasons where the peripherals have been true number one peripherals. And, if not for a stretch he missed last year with a minor ailment, he would have gotten those 200 innings. So, I'm not saying I want him to be my top pitcher in a mixed league because I think if you wait to get him as your top pitcher, you'll be behind the curve as far as your second pitcher goes. But I would expect him to perform about like my number one pitcher, whoever that ends up being.
Well, but what if you take him and then in the next round, like let's say you miss out on the top 12, you know, should fantasy owners try to do everything they can to get a top 12? I remember last year for me, I think there were 10 guys. I don't remember off the top of my head, but you know, Bumgarner was in there. Hamels was in there. Not all of them panned out, but most of them did. 10 guys. I really, really wanted at least one of them. No, just one. I really wanted one of them to be on my team so I could have that anchor for my rotation. But this year, can you feel better about it if you don't get one of those, you know, top 10 or top 12 pitchers and you can get the 15th, 16th best pitcher, whether that's Chris Archer, Garrett Cole, somebody like that, and feel?
Yeah, I say yes. And Carrasco's part of that group with Archer and right. Cole. And I actually have Keuchel outside of my top 12, and he just won a Cy Young. So I think that's what Al was getting at when there's like 20 number ones.
Right.
You probably need two of them if you're going to keep up with everybody else, but it doesn't have to be the front half. One of those two doesn't have to come from the front half of the top 20.
Gotcha. All right, here's your quote of the day, and it's from former Seattle first base coach Andy Van Slyke. And if he was a friend of Robinson Cano's, he's no longer. He said this about a couple of weeks ago on CBS Sports Radio 920 in St. Louis. Quote, Robinson Cano cost the GM his job. The hitting coach got fired because of Cano, and then the manager and the coaches got fired because of Cano, because that's how much impact he has on the organization. He was the worst player, and it cost people their jobs in the process. And then Van Slyke continued, Robinson Cano was the single worst third place everyday player I've ever seen for the first half. Yeah, ever. For the first half of a Major League Baseball season. He did qualify it with that, just the first half. He couldn't drive home Miss Daisy if he tried. He couldn't do it. He couldn't get a hit when it mattered. He played the worst defense I've ever seen at second. I mean, the worst defensive second baseman ever I've ever seen in 20 years in the big leagues.
Woo! I thought Van Slyke had been around longer than that.
I couldn't believe those quotes.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal. And I mean, there's no context in those quotes because he was, dealing with some health issues that, in retrospect were really affecting him.
Yeah.
You know what? Andy Van Slyke was a pretty bad number three hitter in the late stages of his career. I really, if that's the worst he has ever seen, then either he's just the master of overstatement or he hasn't seen that much. And I'm going to go with the former and say that while Cano probably didn't perform up to what he's getting paid and never will, I mean, he's still better than 75% of the second baseman in baseball. Not to mention, hitters in general is a different matter, but just second baseman.
He had a pretty bad UZR last year at minus 7.3 on FanGraphs. So I guess he did not have a very strong season defensively. He used to be such an amazing fielder. I can't believe this. What's happening?
Well, I read something today that not imminently, but that eventually it's a foregone conclusion he'll move to first.
Really?
Which, of course, will affect his fantasy value whenever that does happen. But and I don't remember who was quoted saying that. But
was it Andy Van Slyke?
It was not Andy Van Slyke, no.
I mean, that's basically what happens to middle infielders who can still hit.
Yeah.
Nomar Garciaparra comes to mind, and I'm sure there are plenty of other examples, but that's the one that came to mind.
All right, fellas, let's go through the news and notes here. Jake Arrieta was fatigued in the playoffs, so, you know, we've talked about this a lot. Big, big increase in innings for the Mets guys. Let's talk about Arrieta and tell me if you're concerned. I'm sure Scott isn't based on previous conversations, but 248 and two-thirds innings last season, 248 and two-thirds, including the postseason for Arrieta. In 2014, he threw 176 and two-thirds. So 176.2 or 0.6, whatever, to 248 and two-thirds. And the year before that was 154 and two-thirds. So that's a pretty big jump, and he was tired down the stretch. Does that mean anything to you guys as you draft Jake Arrieta in 2016?
I'll take Scott's angle for him and say it's not going to affect how I draft him at all. And I'm actually just looking here to see if he had a season prior to last year where he pitched more. I think he did. 2012, it looks like he might have 170. Mm. So I guess that's what was it last year or 2 years ago? 176, so roughly the same. He's been around long enough that, I don't know what the past history says with other pitchers, but it doesn't strike me as a problem.
Okay. Jordan Zimmermann is a Detroit
Tiger.
Did
I misrepresent you, Scott?
No. Okay. I just wish I had a better way of explaining why I don't feel like it's a problem. I think it's just because aces who pitch deep into the playoffs always have a lot of innings, and rarely does it become an issue the very next year. So it just seems like you're looking for something to worry about to me.
I just think that, you know, it kind of was an issue with some of the Giants guys, wasn't it? Maybe it wasn't directly the year after. Maybe it was like a cumulative.
Right. It
effect.
Was, I think, a few seasons ago, Kane. Yeah. And who knows if that really was the source of Kane's or Lincecum's issues.
And that, you know, that's, I do think there may be a cumulative aspect to this, just because you look at CC Sabathia's career and he was throwing 230 innings every year for 6 years, and now he's not quite 30. Well, I guess he just turned 35, and which doesn't seem especially old, but he's seems much older than his age.
Yeah,
but there was those 6 seasons, yeah. And like who was predicting it the 7th season as opposed to the 4th or 5th? You know,
right. Yep. Okay, so Jordan Zimmermann on the Detroit Tigers, 5 years, $110 million. He was the number 27 starting pitcher in points leagues. Number 32 in Roto last year, and you guys have him pretty close to there, about 30th. He had a 3.66 ERA, which was much higher than what we had seen in his previous 4 seasons. An ERA between 2.94 and or 2.66 actually in 2014 and 3.18. 2.66 and 3.18, 4 straight years. He just had a bad year last year. So does he bounce back? And this is the thing I'll say: like you can focus on the strikeouts in 2014; they were way up. And they fell back down to earth. But, you know, if he just goes back to his normal strikeout rates, if he just has a better ERA, you know, and just pitches better, he gave up a lot of hits last year, he'll be fine for fantasy. You know, like, what's he going to be?
I'm sorry, Adam.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not really optimistic for him going back to that 2011 to 2013 level. Because First of all, he's switching leagues. So that almost always hurts the pitcher going from NL to AL. And then in each of those 3 seasons, and again, these are the 3 seasons before the big strikeout season for him, there was 1 year the ERA was helped with a very, very low home run to fly ball ratio, another year where he had a very high strand rate, and another year where he had a very low BABIP. So it was almost like every year he found a different way to overperform by just a little bit. So peripherally, the version of Zimmermann we saw last year was very close to the one in those 3 seasons, but without the help from those indicators, each of which can just fluctuate a lot on its own without a skill change. So I think between that and the move to the American League, I think, you know, the odds are not great that he's going to have an ERA under 3.5.
Gotcha. Scott, Detroit acquired Cameron Maben from Atlanta. Is there any fantasy impact here?
Well, I think whatever minimal fantasy appeal Maben had, and he may have been like a fifth outfielder type in Roto, I think that's pretty much shot with this. There is a chance he could just overtake Anthony Gost and be the everyday center fielder, but it's not clear that he would be an upgrade from Gost. And Gost is the left-handed hitter of the two, so if it's a platoon situation, Gost would get more at-bats, and I just don't see this working out well for Maben in the long run.
Kind of weird, actually. Maben has struggled mightily against lefties
Yeah.
each of the last 2 years, so You know, so, is Rajay Davis still there?
Yes.
No, he's gone.
It's free agent.
Yeah. Maven's kind of replacing Rajay Davis.
Gotcha. Okay. Rich Hill and Jay Happ have signed. Rich Hill with Oakland, Jay Happ with Toronto. Who do you guys like better next year, Happ or Hill?
Hill, by a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, just seeing what he did in those four starts for the Red Sox, all of them seven innings or more. Or I'm sorry, that's not true. One was only six innings, but three of them were seven innings or more and 10 strikeouts in all three of those. Like it was a tiny sample size, but it was so much dominance from a pitcher who we've seen dominate. Granted, it was 8 years ago, but it wasn't clear what really went wrong for him when he did fall off the map there. Just a dominant curveball that he seems to have rediscovered, and that's a swing and miss pitch. So I think, the one Achilles heel would probably be the fly ball rate, but he's at Oakland. So that's, you know, giving up home runs isn't going to be as much of a concern there. And I just think he could be, it could be a signing very much like, when Oakland got Scott Kazmir. And, after he had showed some good peripherals with the Indians, but it wasn't like an awesome season. And then he went and became this number three type pitcher in fantasy in Oakland. And I could see Hill, something similar happening for Hill here. And, you know, talking a late round pick, but I think there's a lot of potential for him to exceed the cost there.
Well, you guys have done your drafts. Like, who are some other late round starting pitchers that people are going to take flyers on that are in the same range as Rich Hill?
The guys that I've got, you know, towards the end of my draft, Mike Fiers, Erasmo Ramirez, Jeff Samardzija, Jake Odorizzi.
Okay.
I have Jared Eichhoff in that range, and I think it's similar because they're both curveball guys who didn't put together a full season, but when they did pitch, impressive strikeout rates.
And
I also kind of have Tyler Duffy in that same range, but he has to secure a rotation spot first.
Let's not completely sell Jay Happ short. With the Pittsburgh Pirates, he went 7-2 with a 1.85 ERA and more than a strikeout per inning. He only gave up three homers and 63 and a third, and one of those was at Coors Field. Pretty bad ballpark, though. Now he'll be a Toronto Blue Jay. And I just look at A.J. Burnett, who had two good seasons with the Pirates, and then he was horrible for a year with Philadelphia, and then he went back to the Pirates, and he had a 3.12-ish ERA, 3.18. So, I mean, like, what do you expect from Jay Happ going to Toronto now?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be good. I mean, there's been a lot written about how, he benefited from the Searidge effect, Ray Searidge, pitching coach in Pittsburgh. He was there only about 2 months. And like you said, I think the ballpark itself helped Happ. I think it also helped him a bit in Seattle, although he wasn't quite as successful there. But I just think Rogers Center is just a bad place for Happ to pitch.
I don't like Happ as a mixed league option, period. I feel like he's one of those guys, I guess because of the Ray Searidge angle, that is going to get a lot of buzz on draft day as a sleeper. But only once in those 11 starts for Pittsburgh did he go beyond six innings. So they were being very careful with how they used him. He wasn't especially valuable in fantasy for as low as the ERA was during that stretch because the innings weren't what they should be. And I just don't understand why Toronto wanted nothing more to do with him. They gave him up for Michael Saunders just last offseason, right?
Yeah.
And now they're giving him $12 million a year because of an 11-start stretch where he couldn't go seven innings. So I just think this is going to be a disaster for everybody involved.
Okay, very optimistic view. I like it. I'm coming off that 8.5 Thanksgiving. He's bringing the holiday cheer to the podcast. A few other notes. Boston signed outfielder Chris Young from the Yankees to a two-year deal worth $13 million. Does this have any fantasy impact?
I don't think so, because I don't see him being an everyday outfielder. There's been conjecture about whether or not the Red Sox would move either Jackie Bradley or Rosnia Castillo. But I've seen, speculation that this isn't really going to change that. This is just going to give them some added depth in a right-handed bat. So no, I think he's going to fill a platoon role like he did for the Yankees and probably do it very, very well and be a DFS monster those games when he faces a lefty, and that's about it.
Well, it's weird, though, because he was amazing against lefties last year, but even he was like, I don't have a history of doing that, you know, and he doesn't really. So we'll see if it continues into this year. Last year, he was locked in against lefties. The Marlins hired Juan Nieves as their pitching coach. Did they officially hire Barry Bonds, or is that just...
No, but they have officially made an offer.
Okay. And they've hired Juan Nieves as their pitching coach. I don't know if you guys have anything to say about that. Speak now, forever hold your peace.
No, but they got Jim Benedict. I don't know what his title is with the Marlins, but, you know, pitching guru over from Pittsburgh. And actually, yeah, that's like he came to them from Pittsburgh. And so, I mean, I thought that was an interesting hire.
Oh, my gosh. And they fired Tommy Hutton.
Oh, yeah.
People are pissed off. He's their color broadcaster since their inception, Al?
No, Gary Carter was their original in that role. But they're the only two. Tommy Hutton had been with the Marlins, I think, for 19 years. And, yeah, he was very, very good at his job.
Oh, man. And he's like... The fans probably like Giancarlo Stanton the best. Oh, no, Jose Fernandez 1, Stanton 2, Hutton 3. That's
sounds about right.
They are fired up. They are pissed off about that. And finally, Oakland signed Jed Lowrie. Scott, what's that mean for the A's infielders?
Well, hopefully it means Brett Lowrie is going to be on the move. They decided to go with the other vowel there at second base. Because I'd hate for it to mean Danny Valencia at third base won't enter next season as the starter after the way he finished last year. I've been restrained in my ranking of him so far because it's not clear he's going to be an everyday player going into 2016. But he was to end 2015, and he did some serious damage in that role. 18 home runs and only 345 at-bats. And this is a guy who hadn't really shown much power prior to that. But at the same time, I mean, it was at Oakland, so it's hard for me to think there was nothing to that.
You and can have your Danny Valencia.
At third base with you a late round pick, to me it's a lot more interesting than somebody like Nick Castellanos or even Trevor Plouffe. I feel like Valencia could have similar power, but with better batting average than Plouffe.
Scott, I have
a
question.
So you're not impressed with Valencia?
What's
the
that?
Kane too?
No, yeah, I mean, look, let's be honest here. I went to college with Danny Valencia. I know everything about Danny Valencia.
Oh, really? Is that how it works?
Yeah. No, I just feel like for his entire career, all I could do was hit lefties, and then he just had one good stretch toward the end of the season. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think it's worth a flyer in the late rounds. I'm not sure either. If I was sure, I'd be ranking him, you know, in round 14 or something.
I could buy the flyer thing. I mean, doesn't hurt that late in the draft.
It's a pretty weak position too, third base.
So you are going to talk about it is okay. You are going to talk about your mock drafts and the lessons you've learned. But first, it's time for fun with Twitter polls. Follow us on Twitter at AlMelkCBS, M-E-L-C, at AlMelkCBS, at CBS Scott White, and at Adam Azer, A-I-Z-E-R. Some Twitter polls from Al. And by the way, wait, this is important here.
Okay.
I saw a Twitter poll today that had four options.
What?
Yeah.
Oh. How?
I don't know.
Big.
I just
it's true.
I did. I don't know what that's all about.
How does this happen? And how was I not informed?
I'm informing you right now. I just saw this.
Well, it's some good that does me now.
I'm sorry. I'm on Twitter, and there's a little click thing you click here. A link is what they call it in the business. Add a choice.
Yes.
Add a choice.
Add a choice.
Wow.
This is
amazing.
This is the internet in 2015, folks.
There you go. So wait, what were you saying, Al, before I took
okay,
us
well,
off
no, because, again, now I'll just... To use the feature, I'll have to put up another Twitter poll today.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to include none of the above in every poll.
That's awesome. It was It was so rarely none of the above or all of the above. Maybe all of the above, but it was so rarely none of the above when you took a test back in the day, you know?
Well, I had this teacher once who put none of the above on every single question. And probably a third to a fourth of the time, it was none of the above.
Really?
Very, very tricky, that one.
You know, we have interesting perspective here because Al was a teacher. I'm sure he made some tests in his past before the days as a fantasy baseball analyst. Al, what are your thoughts on all of the above and or none of the above?
See, I think you got to use it sparingly. And sometimes yeah. It just doesn't even apply. Like for these Twitter poll, which are basically rankings dilemma questions, I need an answer.
It's true. It's true. So Jay Bruce versus Evan Gattis was your first one. And
yeah.
We're going to guess, right? We're going to guess the results.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good idea.
Scott, do you know the results?
Not exactly. I know who won, yeah.
All right, I will guess that Evan Gattis won with 59% of the vote.
All right.
For fact-checking?
Yeah, no, I'm because I thought I remembered it, but also I'm waiting for Scott, because I know you said you know who won, but...
Oh.
But since you don't know the percentage...
Should I guess?
I think you should guess.
Gattis won with, like, 64%.
Oh, you are thinking of a different poll, I think, because Gattis did not win.
Whoa!
Or maybe you saw the results before they were final.
Apparently there was a late surge for Mr. J.
There was. This was one where you had to stay up all night watching the electric coverage. Because Jay Bruce just squeaked it out, 51-49.
Oh, okay. Justice is served then.
Yep.
You guys like
that's
Bruce?
That's the way it should be.
Really? Okay. So that's interesting because my first impression was I don't want anything to do with Bruce. He looks like he's on the downside of his career. I went back and looked at the numbers though, and he'll get you 9 steals, which helps. He'll score more runs because Gattis never walks. Okay, so tell me why you guys went Bruce over Gattis.
Well, I think the only thing you can count on from either of these two is home runs and RBI. Bruce can do it at a position other than utility. that's the biggest reason.
Okay.
And I do have some guarded hope that, you know, still, he's not even 30 yet. He can regain whatever's happened to his batting average the last couple years. I'm not counting on it, but I have more hope of him gaining there than I do Gattis at this point.
Well, I think you guys have summed up pretty well for me too, but also part of this for me was about the Evan Gattis triples. Because he hit 11 of them. I think only Eddie Rosario had more last year. And that went a long way towards keeping Gattis's power numbers pretty much where they had been with the Braves in terms of rate. He played more last year, but Dave Brown had a pretty interesting piece on our site a couple weeks back about how many of those triples were really pretty lucky, or, you know, he got a lot of help from the defenders in the outfield in getting that triple. So his isolated power is a little bit bogus, and the home run rate was down last year when we all expected it to go up from him moving from Atlanta to Houston. So I think that they profile as sort of similar guys with low batting average and home runs. Bruce gives you a few steals, and Gattis, I'm concerned he won't be able to keep pace power-wise based on what happened last year.
In case it wasn't inferred from what we've said just now, Gattis isn't catcher eligible next season.
I thought he was outfield eligible, though.
He is not eligible anywhere.
Well, that definitely changes things. But yep. I also...
And I even put that in the poll question that he's DH only.
I also have, the way you're hopeful for Bruce to rebound, like I'm sort of hopeful for Gattis to rebound because he got off to a really slow start. And if you just look at the amount of home runs he hit in Atlanta and the amount of at bats, maybe this was just a bad year for him. You know, maybe, who knows? I'm not going to speculate on if he was pressing or whatever, but maybe it was just a bad year. And for Bruce, it's been 2 bad years in a row and terrible batting average. So I just kind of feel like there's, Gattis could have a monster home run season. I don't know.
I have a hard time thinking the first year somebody gets full time at bats, oh, he had a bad year. That just doesn't compute for me. Like, this was the first year he got a chance to be an everyday player. Maybe it was the normal year for him.
Okay. That's a good point. All right. Our next Twitter poll from Mr. Melchior. Joe Ross versus Tyson Ross, keeping it in the family. All right. Okay, Scott, do you know the results here?
Oh, Tyson Ross. By a pretty healthy margin, I'll say 71%.
I will say Tyson Ross 54%.
All right, let's split the difference. I think Scott was a little closer, 66% for Tyson, 34 for Joe. I thought it might be a little bit closer because, well, when I put these questions out there, it's usually because they're players that are close in my rankings or I'm actually not even sure which order to put them. And I was surprised when I was starting to put my rankings together how close I was going to put Tyson and Joe Ross. So I did put Tyson ahead, but not much.
Yeah, I think the clear advantage Joe has over Tyson is control. I don't think we have much hope of Tyson Ross ever being even an average walk guy, and that impacts his whip, it impacts his innings, impacts everything a little bit. But what he has in his favor is provenness, because yeah. Joe Ross hasn't even pitched 80 innings in the majors, and I always think back to Daniel Hudson, if you ever want to see a guy who looked like he was a world beater his first third of a season in the majors, and then was fine after that, but wasn't nearly as big of a deal. That's always what I worry about, particularly in the case of Joe Ross. It's not like he was this super elite prospect. He was a good prospect, but he wasn't like they weren't having a countdown in Washington to the day he gets called up. So I like him, but I think Tyson Ross has already carved out his place as a top 40 pitcher in fantasy, and you know, Joe Ross is, in my rankings, a good 16 spots behind that.
Boy, did this podcast go absolutely crazy for Joe Ross last year or what?
Deservedly. I said, I like him. The ratios look really good. He's like, Tyson Ross has a strikeout advantage too. But overall, the peripherals look better for Joe Ross if he can sustain them over a full season.
I'm just going to say something. It might be a little bit weird, but I'm going to say it anyway. Al, if this fantasy baseball thing doesn't work out for you, you could be a department store mannequin. I thought our video feed was frozen, but it turns out you were just staying like extremely still for the last 30 seconds. That was really impressive.
That is really comforting to know that I've got that kind of plan B.
Yeah. I was
only
like, oh,
problem
crap.
Is the guys doing that job right now are doing it for free. So you might have to. You'd be revolutionizing the whole industry.
I was transfixed by Twitter.
I'm tired of the plastic people taking away jobs from real Americans.
For real.
I'll be honest with you. Okay, Gio Gonzalez versus Kyle Hendricks. I don't even think I would have voted in this Twitter poll, Al. I don't want either of these guys.
Well, I always get, Scott talked to, or one of you talked about none of the above.
There you go.
So there's always somebody who replies back and says, well, why would I want either of these guys? So I got that response to this one.
I'm going to guess that Gio Gonzalez won 62-38.
Yeah, it was pretty handy victory. I'll go 70.
You see, you guys, you underestimate Kyle Hendricks. He got 43%, so Gio did get 57%, but was closer than you thought. I thought this one was interesting, too, because I know, Adam, I know you were very frustrated with Gio last year. I think a lot of owners probably were. Hendricks, on the surface, had a down season compared to his rookie year, but I like him as a sleeper this year, and I figure Gio's going to go first, but I think there might be enough of sort of downward momentum with him. I thought this would be close.
You know, I like Hendricks as a sleeper too, but if you're going to start comparing him to Gio Gonzalez, that sleeper appeal is going to dry up, because Gio Gonzalez is just, even coming off a bad year, I think he has too much name value to last much beyond like round 14, round 15. And I think he might actually be a value there, because peripherally, what he did last year was basically what he's been doing with the Nationals all along in terms of home runs and strikeout to walk ratio. He was the exact same pitcher. He just allowed a lot more hits. Mm-hmm. And maybe that had to do with defense. And, obviously he's going to have more or less the same defense behind him, but I just think it was such a dramatic shift in that hit rate that there's going to be some regression in that area, and he's going to shave a good 0.2 off that whip and be exactly where we're used to seeing him, in the top 36 starting pitchers once the season. I don't have him ranked as a top 36 because there's no reason to rank him that high, but I think there's a very good chance he ends up back in there when all's said and done.
I really do think, not because I think that Gonzalez doesn't have a chance to rebound somewhat, but I think because of what Hendricks showed last year and his ability to get called strikes, to bump up that strikeout rate to a very good rate, and he has better control than Gonzalez, I think they'll have similar value. I do agree, Scott, that you're not going to have to reach for Hendricks. Maybe you have to reach a little bit more given these poll results, that it wasn't a runaway by Gonzalez. But there are a good number of owners out there who would rather have Hendricks. I won't feel the need to reach for him before Gio goes off the board, but I do think that they'll wind up being similarly
productive. Just to demonstrate what I was saying about how his peripherals were as good as ever, he had Gio Gonzalez had a 305 FIP last year, which is an estimate of ERA based on the peripherals a pitcher has direct control over. 305 in 2015 compared to 302 in 2014, and actually 341 in 2013. So, you know, it, by some measurements, it was actually not his worst season as a National.
Yeah, FIP makes my skin crawl. I will say that. I hate it. I hate XFIP. I like ERA.
I was going to Sierra?
What?
That's another ERA estimator.
Oh, God. What is it called?
Sierra.
Sierra. Give me a break. I like Ruben Sierra, Al. That's the only Sierra we need.
It's Russell Wilson's favorite ERA estimator.
Sierra. Let me ask you this, Adam. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think home run rate, strikeout rate, and walk rate, not necessarily in that order, but do you think those three are the biggest determinants to how good a pitcher is?
Yeah, sure.
Well, that's basically all FIP is measuring.
Yeah, I know. I just...
Maybe you don't... I don't know how literally we should take the number it spits out as, okay, this is what the ERA should have been. I don't know if that's something we should take so literally, but it's a good way of kind of mashing those three ratios into just one number that tells you how good the pitcher should be relative to everyone else, just in terms of those ratios.
That's fine. I'm sure there's a lot of merit to it. You know, I guess just during the season, I don't know how I feel about it because, you know, if you're struggling because of defense, unless the defense changes, you're going to keep struggling in theory. So, you know, with a new team or with new defenders behind you, then I could buy into it more.
Which, by the way, will be the case.
Yeah.
For Gio.
It's not always just defense, though. I mean, a lot of times it's luck, too. Mm-hmm. In terms of it's getting through.
Well, let's talk about what you guys wanted to talk about, and those are the lessons you learned in your mock drafts that you did by yourselves, because you guys are weird. So what are some of the takeaways that you came up with? Go ahead.
My biggest takeaway is actually a continuation of something I've noticed over the last few years, but this year I'm all about it, fully on board. Starting pitcher will be and absolutely should be a much bigger priority in the early rounds this year. In my head-to-head points mock draft, 15 of the first 37 players I took were starting pitchers. And the reason for that is because while this past year, offense was back up, after a trend where it was going down, pitching was getting an advantage, offense went back up again. And yet, look at what the best pitchers did. We had, I mean, the Cy Young vote, the NL Cy Young vote really brought this to light where, okay, Jake Arrieta, Zach Greinke, Clayton Kershaw, any other year, any one of them would win, but two of them have to lose this year. And I think what kind of got lost in that whole discussion is the year Max Scherzer had. He had the best year of his career, and he's a former Cy Young winner. The stat I like to point to, and I guess WHIP is kind of an arbitrary measure, but I think it's a measure that carries over well historically. Over the last 40 years, four of the top 15 WHIP seasons of the last 40 years were accomplished this year by Arrieta, Greinke, Kershaw, and Scherzer. And so what I'm getting at is offense was better this year. yet the very best starting pitcher was better than as long as any of us have been playing fantasy. So we keep seeing every year the new pitchers enter that mix of ace level to the point that now Al and I were saying there's a good 20 of them. And yet very few are dropping out because of injury or anything else. And it's created this interesting situation at starting pitcher where, you know, on the one hand, it may be a fairly deep position, but on the other hand, if you're one who doesn't have a pitcher who's putting up those stud numbers every time out, it's going to be very hard for you to compete. It's okay, to the point where...
But, like, if you talk about those four guys, Scherzer, Kershaw, Greinke, and Arrieta, only two of them were drafted with really early picks. You know, and Arrieta and Greinke were early picks, but they weren't first
or
second round.
That's kind of what I'm saying. They keep getting added with few being removed. So now there's this abundance of aces that are going to go early. And if you're not one who really, you have to get two, like I was saying earlier, I think if five rounds go by, certainly in a points league, maybe you can get away six rounds in a roto. But if five or six rounds go by and you don't have two starting pitchers yet, you're going to be in trouble at that position because, you know, having somebody like Tyson Ross or Garrett Richards or Jordan Zimmermann as your number two starting pitcher, it just isn't getting it done with the way the pitching landscape is right now.
Now, I may have to redo this whole draft because, Scott, the key point here, I think, is getting that second ace because I had a much slower pace of drafting starting pitchers. You said you had 15 in your top 37.
Yeah.
I had 11 in my top 37, and it took me 50 picks to get to my 15th. So, and you were saying, you know, if you don't have two by the end of the fifth round, well, that was early in the fifth round that I was just getting to the end of my top 15. So, what I was thinking as I was going through this and kind of taking on the, you know, the persona of each of the 12 owners in the draft, you know, looking at what their needs are. I looked on the board and said, well, okay, there's 20 number one pitchers that are, you know, most of whom are pretty interchangeable in value. So I need to grab a first baseman, which first base is surprisingly thin this year. That's one where year after year, I've been willing and able to wait on it. You know, I went after first base early. I went, you know, I filled other positions early, and then a little bit later on was where I felt the need for these teams to go on a run. So, you know, I could see that going either way, Scott's way or my way, because it's really that second half of those number one pitchers where, okay, yeah, you can wait to get the first one, but then the heat is on to get the second one to keep up with everybody else.
It just depends when those first dominoes fall and when you have to react to them. If you're in a situation like, you kept passing him up in each of those positions because you're like, oh, I have all those guys to fall back on.
Yeah.
But I think the way I see it going is guys in that middle portion of that top 20, the Dallas Keuchels, Gerrit Coles, even the Felix Hernandezes of the world, to me, they seem much more elite than some of the hitters you could draft in that same range, like a Ryan Braun or Todd Frazier. Or I have Corey Seager ranked about that high.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which seems like the better foundational player for a fantasy team? And to me, it's the pitchers. They're the ones with the track records, and they're the ones who stand out more over the middle tier players at their position.
But that's always going to be the case. Like in round 15, the pitchers you can draft are going to be a lot better than the hitters you can draft. And every round, that's pretty much going to be the case, except maybe the first two or maybe three. I don't know.
I don't think that's true anymore. I see a huge drop off in terms of expectations at starting pitcher around the top after like 22 or so. I think it is. You basically go from true number ones and fringe number ones to number threes instantly.
And so what you're saying is there are more elite or potentially elite starting pitchers, and you've got opportunities to get two of them, and a lot of fantasy owners are going to have two of them, so you need to be one of them, one of those owners.
I think so.
Okay.
And that's probably going to mean getting two in either the first five or six rounds.
Okay. Other observations, Al, you mentioned first base. How would you compare first base to outfield?
I'm sorry?
How would you compare first base to outfield?
Outfield is just so much deeper. And just a year ago, I was complaining that it was really hard to get a good number one outfielder if you didn't go early. And now I feel much better about both the quality and the depth at outfield. But first base, even, you know, we have truncated rankings on the site right now. And it was kind of hard to fill out the latter part of that top 12.
Yeah.
I've got Adrian Gonzalez 10th. Mm-hmm. He's somebody you definitely want to have in that top 12. But I've got Hosmer 11th and Mark Teixeira 12th.
Yeah. That's what's going to end up happening because Buster Posey is in that top 12. Mm-hmm. So it's really 11 first basemen you just reviewed there.
Yeah.
Two people in a 12-team league are going to have to draft Albert Pujols and Mark Teixeira as their starters. Now, Pujols isn't going to be available for the first month in all likelihood, and Teixeira, he might only be available for a month given his injury history. So they both need to have a really good fallback option at the position, those two people in a 12-team league. And there's not great fallback options there. It's guys like Lucas Duda or Ryan Zimmerman, ones you'd be on the fence about starting as your utility player. We're talking more of a head-to-head lineup here than one with corner infield spots and everything. So that really demonstrates the depth. And I compare it to something like second base, where you look at the top 12 at that position, and it's a lot of guys who are very similar to ones in the top six or seven. Ian Kinsler, Dustin Pedroia, Logan Forsyth, Ben Zobrist, guys with question marks, but who aren't really that different from like an Anthony Rendon or a Rougned Odor, who have their own question marks. So I feel like while you'd think of second base being a weaker position in a shallower league where you're not really having to consider corner infield spots and second baseman, you're probably better off waiting at second base than first base.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, I've felt that in the past, but just because, well, if I don't get somebody good right away, then what does it matter because it's such dregs? But yeah, there's quality options outside the top 12 at second base. And by the way, I initially had Devin Travis outside my top 12, and he's got, you know, he's had shoulder surgery, going to miss some time. But because of the immense upside that's there, I actually found that I decided to draft him ahead of Dustin Pedroia, even though initially I had Pedroia ranked higher, because I think when Travis does come back, he's going to be, you know, he's going to have almost as much upside as anybody. But that means Dustin Pedroia is outside my top 12. And I'm perfectly fine with him as a starting second baseman.
Yeah, I have him 12. I think maybe Logan Forsyth is the one I have outside my top 12 that you have in it. Mm-hmm. I agree. Daniel Murphy's only 15th, and I think he's a perfectly serviceable mixed league starter at second base. So yes, first base by comparison, I think one point to bring up though is I don't know that at the end of the season we're still going to see it that same way, because presumably Prince Fielder will regain first base eligibility, Kendrys Morales will, David Ortiz will at some point. It's just a position where it's very easy for players with good bats to get five games over the course of a season. But going into the season, it looks pretty weak.
So three of your first four or five picks, not necessarily should be, but wouldn't be a bad idea if you're talking two pitchers and a first baseman in there?
I think that's very likely, because there's still plenty of first basemen who deserve to go very early. It's just there's not many fallback options after those, Edwin Encarnacion, Jose Abreu types.
So who does that push back into good value in, you know, the third or the fourth round? Are any of the really good shortstops or third basemen falling, or catcher? Well, catcher, forget, but or maybe it's the outfielders. You know, who benefits from this push on pitchers and first basemen early?
Yeah, I would say outfield for sure. I found in this draft that there were some pretty good outfielders available late.
Now, Al, you were doing three outfielder. Sorry, guy. Is this a three outfielder format or five outfielders?
Three outfielder.
All right, yeah. Well, that changes things.
But... Well, by late, what do you mean? Rounds?
15, 16.
Oh, okay. What kind of outfielders are you?
All right. So I'm looking here to see who. Jay Bruce.
Yeah.
Ender Inciarte. Jorge Soler. Denard Span.
I actually have Soler going in round 21, so there's even more value there in a three outfielder league potentially. But I don't know. I guess that does seem pretty deep compared to other positions, but I don't feel like in round 7 and 8, I don't feel like the hitters that would be drafted in round 7 and 8 because more people were drafting pitchers in rounds 1 through 5 are hitters that would normally go in rounds 1 through 5. For me, it's guys like Eric Hosmer and Corey Dickerson, Robinson Cano, the injured Albert Pujols is going in that round 7 and 8 range for me. So those aren't like I don't feel like deserving hitters are getting pushed back because more pitchers are there, which kind of plays into my point that the pitchers are the more deserving early rounders too.
All right, last question. What you just said about first base, does that make you prioritize Paul Goldschmidt over Harper and Trout?
It helps.
Sorry, I put that the wrong order. Paul Goldschmidt over Trout and Harper is the way I should have said it. Sorry.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to think about because my kind of knee-jerk response to that is, well, okay, but then you're dealing with a drop-off from Harper and Trout and Harper, however, whichever way you want to put it.
Yeah, Trout and Harper, yeah.
at the end of round 2. And just because first base is shallow, I mean, there's still the top ones are all really good. And I have no problem winding up with Joey Votto or Anthony Rizzo or somebody like that.
Well, neither of them are going to fall to the guy who drafted Harper or Trout. Jose Abreu might.
Chris Davis and Jose Abreu I have towards the end of the second round. Nothing wrong with those guys.
No. I would agree with that. But to give you an idea of how close they are, I've been working on auction values all day. For my mixed league auction values, Harper, Trout, Goldschmidt, I all have as $40 bids. So no distinguishment in terms of auction dollars there for me.
Okay. Well, then let's read some emails at fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. This is from Tim in Torquay, Australia. He says, hi, Grant, Peter, and Liam.
Grant Balfour, Liam Hendricks, and somebody else Australian.
Peter Moylan.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
There you go.
Good call.
I play, well, he put it in the email, so.
Yeah. I see it now.
I play in a 16-team head-to-head 7x7 categories league with doubles and triples, and OBP being the two additional offensive categories. I think doubles and triples is one category. I need to keep two of these three outfielders next year. Shin-Soo Choo, Hanley Ramirez, and Alex Gordon.
I'm just looking to see if there's any reason to keep Hanley with these categories, and I don't.
I have Hanley one spot ahead of Choo in my rankings. I'm sorry, but I do. Actually, I think I have them both ahead of Gordon.
Let's see
how about that?
I don't think I do.
But if OBP's a category, yeah, I think Gordon's the one I'm going to give up just because I think the upside is the most lacking for him. Obviously, there's reasons to be concerned about Hanley Ramirez being ever good again, but he's had underwhelming seasons before and then bounced back with first round type numbers. So I'm just reluctant to assume that's not going to happen again.
Now, I think Alex Gordon, we looked it up last time, wasn't he a big home road split guy and we just kind of never really noticed it because he's a free agent?
No, I think we noticed he wasn't a big home
road split.
Oh,
he wasn't.
Yeah, I don't remember him being one.
Okay. I'll take a look after I read this next email. Kevin has three bold predictions from us. You can react to all three. Bold prediction number one, Carlos Correa consensus projected number one overall pick in 2017, immediately after 2016.
I love it. I love it. And I actually have him sixth now.
Ooh.
Overall.
I just think that's so risky. Unnecessarily risky. But at the same time, this one...
Risky, yeah, but for a reason. Because yeah. I think that the potential for a gargantuan gap in value between him and everybody else in that position.
I know, but I just think the easiest way to sabotage your season is to blow your first round pick.
Well,
so I mean, you know, Anthony Rizzo, I think barring freak injury, there's no way he doesn't deliver numbers befitting a first round pick. So it's easy for me to pass up a Carlos Correa at that point, but I agree the upside's big, and eventually I think here there will be that big of a gap between him and every other shortstop. So I could see it happening in 2017, but I don't want to draft him in 2016 like it's going to happen.
Yeah, I understand that. But if he has the season I think he's going to have this year, he will be the number one pick in 2017.
Okay, bold prediction number two. Kyle Schwarber equals Gronk Light. If he slips to you, and he will in some drafts, in mid to late round two, you must draft Kyle Schwarber, if and only if he retains catcher eligibility and in roto leagues.
That is a great analogy.
You have him going in the second round? Kyle Schwarber?
I don't think I do, no.
Oh, okay.
No, because I love the Gronk analogy.
Oh, okay.
I'm going in the fifth.
Yeah, and well, that's in head-to-head. You haven't done a roto one, right?
Right.
In my head-to-head, I would be taking him around six, and in my roto, where you prioritize a catcher because you're starting two, and particularly one who's excels in home runs like Schwarber does, I have him going in round four in that format. So I just think, you know, mid-round two sounds more like Buster Posey range. And to me, there's a big enough gap between those two in terms of everything they bring to the table, because Schwarber looks like just a homer-only guy, and also provenness, that one variable that nobody seems to give enough credit to.
Bold prediction number three. At least this is the one that I don't agree with. But hey, it's a bold prediction. at least three of the following will be consensus undrafted in 2017. John Lester, Shelby Miller, Michael Pineda, Johnny Cueto, and Justin Verlander.
Three of them?
Three yeah, I'm not them. Buying it. I'll buy Miller and Pineda, possibly. But not any of the other three.
Well, yeah.
I mean, look, it could happen if Verlander reverts back to what he was early last season and before. If Cueto continues in a downward, you know,
yeah,
makes
well,
a legitimate
what I was what I was thinking was Cueto is has Tommy John surgery,
yeah,
but even if he does, I think given his track record, he's still going to be drafted in mixed leagues.
Yeah, no, I don't expect,
even if he's projected to miss half of next season.
I don't see it with Lester at all. I just
no.
don't see that one coming.
Yeah.
And I really think it's extremely unlikely for Cueto or Verlander.
Yeah, Pineda's the only one I could see it for, but I don't really see it for any of them.
Last year, I think I've already forgotten, but Alex Gordon had a better batting average at home, but more power on the road. The previous 2 years, he had a much better batting average on the road, but similar power. So I don't really think there's a huge home road split thing to be looking at here. Yeah, last year he had 286 at home and 258 on the road, but he had five more homers on the road in the same amount of games. So there you go. Final email comes from Greg in Massachusetts. Dear Peter, Quagmire, and Joe, I was in a position to sell off some decent players at the end of last season to put myself in a good position in next year's draft. So I have 18 picks in the first 10 rounds of a 25-round draft. If put in this situation, would you try to draft high-risk/upside guys or players with a known history who may have a lower ceiling but a higher floor? 18 picks in the first 10 rounds.
I would go more upside than I normally would in this situation because you've built yourself some cushion if they don't work out.
I just wonder how this is going to impact roster size. Like I assume he can still roster. He's still rostering the same number of players. So if you went too overboard for upside and you're waiting to figure out which of those upside picks is going to pay off, you don't leave yourself any room to drop anybody. And so you may be suffering through a wasted venture. I agree with the general principle. I just think you should still aim to draft a lineup you can trust as your starting lineup to begin the season, and maybe use the excess picks for, you know, some really selling out for upside.
Greg, you better finish in the top three in your league. All right. 18 picks in the first 10 rounds. You better win it. But I know there's some luck involved in that, but you better dominate this league. That is a huge advantage. Holy cow.
It is. I don't like trading picks.
I've never done it before.
Yeah.
Maybe I will someday. Maybe I'll make a Twitter poll about it with four options. All right, guys. Thank you very much. This was fun. Always fun.
Always is. Even when the hot stove is
just
still warming up.
This was a
really
definite,
old stove.
This was a definite
I gotta think
8 point.
Of a, more than two answer poll question.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. But this was definitely an 8.5 podcast.
Yeah.
Awesome stuff.
Like my Thanksgiving.
For Scott White, now Melchior, I'm Adam Azer. And we'll talk to you next week. Fantasy Baseball at CBSi.com.